That's Hebrews chapter 11, beginning at verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, Abraham, even though he was past age, and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. Amen. What does faith do? Now, you might think that question is contradictory. You might think to yourself, well, we're used to knowing that we live by faith, we're justified by faith, and not by what we do. But look how the New Testament holds out Abraham to us. Let's think about what kind of relationship he enjoyed with God. It's quite certain that he didn't try to earn anything from God by what he did. We have that firmly in Romans 4. What does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. To the man who does not work, but trusts God, who justifies the wicked, his faith is credited as righteousness. And Paul there in Romans isn't interpreting anything. He's quoting Genesis. He's telling us what Moses himself, the giver of the law, told us about how Abraham was right with God, apart from doing anything, by his faith. What Abraham received were gifts. And yet here in our passage today, we have a catalogue of Abraham's works, which were by faith. Isn't there supposed to be a contradiction between faith and works? Well, no. Because a gift that you receive can change your life. The expectation of a gift in the future, a gift that is certain, a gift that you're not going to earn, can transform the way that you live now. Imagine somebody sitting on the front row here, Bob, who commutes every day into the city. And I say to him, Bob, on Tuesday morning, a helicopter is going to be given to you as a free gift, with all its fuel and maintenance and a pilot. And beginning on Tuesday morning, you're going to be collected from your home and dropped off at your office. And collected from your office when you ring and dropped off at home. Your commuting time is going to be reduced from an hour and 15 minutes to 12 minutes and 27 seconds if there's no wind. That's a gift, right? Bob hasn't earned any of that. Nothing that he can do will earn it. He's a poor city worker. He can't possibly afford a helicopter. But tomorrow morning, I go to Chelmsford train station and find Bob there at the ticket office. And I say, Bob, are you excited? This is the last train ticket you're ever going to have to buy. And he says, no, I'm just here renewing my annual season ticket to go to Liverpool Street and back. And I say to him, what are you doing? You don't want to do that. You've got this helicopter coming for you in future. And he turns around and says, hey, no. The helicopter's not by works. The helicopter's by faith. Stop telling me how I should live here in the ticket office. Nothing I do can change the helicopter. The helicopter is a gift. Now, he's right, but he's missed the point, hasn't he? Why would you spend, I don't even know what it costs these days, why would you spend another year's worth of your resources into an annual ticket which you're not going to need when you know that you're not going to need it? You'd have to be a little bit insane, wouldn't you? We'd be standing around Bob at coffee time thinking, well, is he allowed hot drinks? Do we need to put him somewhere where it's quiet and he doesn't get too excited? Do you see, to live in a way that makes sense because of a free gift that is coming isn't to say that we're going to earn that gift. It isn't even to say that there are conditions attached to earning that gift. You can have your season ticket and ride the helicopter, it's fine. It's simply to say that the free gift coming in the future makes a nonsense of certain ways of living, and in particular of investing your time and your emotions and your energy and all your resources. If there are certain gifts coming in the future, and there are, you might want to adjust how you live in the light of them. Because as we look now at Abraham in Hebrews 11, Abraham and his children and grandchildren, the astonishing thing is that what we are seeing is a life that turned itself upside down, a life wholeheartedly devoted to the living God, a life full of exemplary and proverbial good works, because it did not earn anything by them, but because it was a life that knew that salvation was coming, that salvation was there by faith alone. Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. So let's see how that worked itself out. The first thing we learn here from Abraham in this passage is that faith lives now in light of the future. Faith lives now in light of the future. Do you see, Abraham left his home because God promised him another home. That's faith. Verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. He knew that God had made him a promise of a great inheritance, so he left what he had, abandoned it, and went to go and get what was promised, even though he didn't even know exactly where it was. He couldn't leave a forwarding address. If he'd had an HP printer, he couldn't have had a stack of labels and left them there for the postman. The Royal Mail had to burn his letters. There was no conveyancing. There was no plot of land anywhere with his name on it. There was no point asking Barclays what their mortgage rates were yet. He had no clue where he was going. And he left what he had because faith believes God's certain promise. That was enough for him. That was enough for him to look soberly at what he has right now and wave it goodbye because he knows what kind of God makes promises. Do you see verse 9? By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. You see, Abraham knew God had said to him quite clearly that he himself would not own the land of promise. He knew that his descendants would, after a few generations, be taken captive out of the land and would wait in captivity for four centuries before being given the land. But Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob lived on and off in the land. His great-grandson Joseph didn't. That's why he comes in a later section. Often they left the land because of famines or family feuds, but they always kept a stake in the promised land. When it came time to bury his wife, Abraham paid a king's ransom for a tiny plot of ground to bury her in, because he knew that 4.5 centuries later, his descendants would own that entire country, and he wanted Sarah to be buried there, where in the future his descendants would have that free gift. But it's hard to find in the life of Abraham him forking out a penny for anything else in the land, because he knew that it was not going to be his or his children permanently for a long time. That's why he lived in tents. That doesn't mean living in squalor. It wasn't sort of year-round under canvas. It's more like in the Korean War, the Americans had these MASH units, Mobile Army Surgical Hospitals. Decent enough place to live for a soldier, for a surgeon, with everything you need for a hospital, in principle mobile, but most of the time fixed in one place. That was Abraham. Most of the time rooted in one place, but I'm not going to dig a foundation because I'm not here forever. I know that I'm not going to inherit this. See, he had no problem with the idea of living in a city, but he knew that any city he set about building wouldn't be his for long. It wouldn't last. It was centuries in the future. Let me ask you, if I offered to lock you up in a small space such that you could sit, you couldn't really stand, ceiling is too low, and I offered to lock you up in it for 12 hours, how much money would you pay me for that privilege? If I said to you, actually, let me make you a better offer. Let me lock you up in a space that's a bit bigger, where maybe you can stretch your legs a bit more. How much more would you pay me for that privilege? Let's say I locked you up in a space that was big enough for you to have maybe a little bed, for one, where you can curl up on your side. How much would you pay me for that immense privilege of being locked up with stale, manufactured air, not able to move, often having to strap yourself? Yeah? Why do people pay for premium economy, for upper class? Why do I find it so alluring when I see it? It's because we forget that I'm only going to be in this airplane for 12 hours. We forget that I'm not making my home here. I tell you, one of these days I'm going to see somebody walk in there with an IKEA flat pack and start building furniture, because the airlines are trying to make us think, make yourself at home. This is very significant. This is not just getting you from A to B, but when you think rationally, you know that whatever it says on your ticket, you're still fighting commuters on the way to Liverpool Street and on the tube. You've still got to lug your suitcases there at the other end. You've still got to clear immigration. The flight is a tiny part of your whole journey. And if you lose sight of that, you waste your resources on something so uncomfortable that when you take it out of context, The United Nations would come and shut you down if you tried to do it. And that was Abraham, not wasting his resources on the short term, which he knew weren't going to be there for very long. Why? Verse 10. Because he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God himself. Abraham's life was a life of faith. It wasn't a life of saying to himself, because the gift is coming for sure, it doesn't matter how I live. No, his life was one of impeccable reasoning. I know the gift is coming. I know what I get right now. I know what I'm not going to get until later. I know what it is that only my descendants will get. And in light of those three facts, I will invest accordingly. You almost want to arrest him for insider trading, don't you? He was so canny, so spectacularly clear-headed in knowing which way his private stock market was going to go. And if you're thinking, wow, that was Abraham, he's heroic, that's spectacular faith. Well, not really. Look with me at verse 11. And look down with me at the NIV footnote, which I think gets this absolutely right. By faith, even Sarah, who was past age, was enabled to bear children. Sarah is not a paragon of faith when you read her life in Genesis. The things we're told about her, now doubtless they are exceptions in her life, but the things that stand out are actually her cynicism towards God, her chuckling at God's promises, her lack of belief. But in God's economy, that life was the life of faith. Abraham is not here as an example to the super missionaries of the world who are willing to go and die of dysentery within 2 weeks of doing God's word. It's here for normal believers like Sarah, like me, like all of us here, who believe the gospel, and this is the life that opens up for us because God's promises are true. And so, verse 12, from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. Came descendants. That's us, right? Hey, we're in the Bible. Did you know that we're in the Bible? We're right there in Hebrews 11, verse 12. Faith, like that of Abraham and Sarah, lives right now in light of the future. And we right here are Abraham's future. You might not think the church is already as numerous as all that, but we're getting there. Abraham lived in a way that made sense. If Abraham lived in a way that made sense, if God is reliable for his promises. That's the only thing which affects whether Abraham's life was sensible or daft. But God was and is and always will be reliable to keep his promises. And that is why faith lives in the light of what is true given what he says. So as we think about how to spend our lives and ourselves, there are some investments that Jesus tells us to take care of more than others. Not because of the inherent value of them, but because some have more firmer promises attached about the future. So right here today, instead of investing in our private leisure, which is a good thing, we're here this evening investing in each other, aren't we? Today, and we're discouraged, aren't we, from worrying about all manner of things tomorrow. This week, we might look after relatives who need us right now, and as we do it, Jesus is discouraging us from worrying about our financial provision later on. We might, if you're a parent, invest in your children right now, knowing that as you do it, you're having to sort of shut your thoughts to, okay, what about accommodation or something else in the future? And it's not that some of these things are more important than others. Everything in Abraham's life that he could have invested in, was important to God. All the things that Abraham left in Ur of the Chaldeans were important to him. But it's that we have certain promises to go on which help us to rearrange our priorities and to rearrange what we think of as a certain thing as opposed to, I'm going to have a go, but it might not work out. And in particular, God has not promised us, any of us, a stable financial future. It seems to me that only Christians believe that anymore, because in the world, everybody knows that if somebody comes along preaching to you a stable financial future, they are a fruitcake. And the only people crazier than people who make those promises are the people who believe them. Jesus certainly doesn't make that sort of lunatic promises. So if I were working on the high street and I had a choice, what will I do for the next hour if I'm paid by the hour? Will I work for this hour and put the money in a junior cash ISA? Well, that's a great thing to do. It's a good thing to do. An important thing to do. A relatively decent investment. Or spend that hour, go home, half an hour playing ball in the backyard, half an hour reading the Bible to my kids. That too is a good investment. Neither of them is better than the other. Both are necessary things to a well-ordered, wise life. But one of them, I'm confident of the return. The other one of them, well, I've got to have a go, but I don't know where the return is going to be. Please don't mishear me. I'm not saying here, it's not written between the lines, I'm not saying please spend less money on yourself and give money to us in the church. No, don't worry. The church has to live like this. Don't you worry about the financial stability of the church. That's the worry of people who meet out there to pray before the service. Again, that's not your problem. Yeah? I might actually be saying to you, actually, most of my friends, if they became Christians, I'd have to say to them, earn less money. Make it less easy for you to support the church financially and start spending some time with your own flesh and blood or looking after your aged mother or that sort of thing. But the point is, it makes more sense for me to teach, help, encourage, and model for my boys the joy of celebrating the Lord's Day with other Christians than to fret about whether they might be missing out on, I don't know, a rugby club or a cricket club or some other business. Not because any of those things are anything other than great, which they are. Sports are fantastic. People who are good at playing sport tell me that sport is fantastic. But the thing I'm sure of is that when we're all gathered around the throne of the Lamb, we're not going to worry about missed opportunities in this world. We're just going to be glad that we are right there, gathered around the Lamb. And if that is our future, if that is God's promise, why would we not help each other now? And particularly parents, particularly me, because I'm rubbish at this, to help our own flesh and blood, to see that what we're doing right now is great because of the certain promise that is coming. See, Abraham in Genesis, he shows actually something close to disdain for his earthly possessions. I don't think he had a financial advisor. If he had, he'd probably resign in disgust. Because people were tripping over themselves to give Abraham possessions. And in fact, God made sure that he had them. God kept giving them to him, even though Abraham doesn't seem to care about them. But Abraham did show immense concern for Isaac and who he should marry. Swear to me on oath that he will not marry a Canaanite. Swear to me that if you do not find a wife from within my own family, you will go back to Ur of the Chaldees and find someone there. It must be that my son marries in the faith. He spent that ridiculous sum of money burying his wife in the land of promise, but didn't own a plot for himself to live on. When his cousin Lot gets taken captive, he goes all out with all of his manpower, all of his resources to free him. And when he wins that war, and the allied kings who are with him say, here, have a share of the spoils, he won't even touch it. See, Abraham's use of his own resources, his time, his emotion, everything, it makes no sense. It makes no sense whatsoever unless God made to him certain promises that through his seed and at a future time, he would bless the world. And those promises are certain. And Abraham believed them. And that is why he lived this radical life by faith. Because that is what faith does. Faith lives now in light of the future. Not to earn the future, but because the future is certain. Secondly, faith lives in this world in light of Jesus. Faith lives in this world in light of Jesus. Do you see verse 13 with me? All these people, that is Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, and Jacob, were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers, wait for it, on earth. Now you'd expect them to say, in the land. Which is it? Because you see, they really did live in the land of promise as aliens and strangers in a very physical sense. They didn't marry people from the land. They didn't own the ground. They lived in tents. They came and went. And is that simply because they knew the land wasn't theirs yet? Or might there be more to it than that? Well, it turns out there is more to it than that. Verse 14. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. Now, lest we become confused and think, okay, a different country than that physical country. Well, no. Verse 15. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. See, if they didn't invest in the promised land because they knew that actually a sensible investment is back in the Chaldees, well, they could have just taken the next, you know, camel caravan and gone back. No, they knew that the land wasn't their own fatherland yet. They were looking for a different fatherland, not the land of their own fathers. They were looking for, verse 16, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. And therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. See, it's a great mistake to think that God merely promised Abraham a huge plot of land in the Middle East and a lot of descendants, because that is not what the Bible says. It's not what Genesis says. God made Abraham eternal, heavenly promises. And that is why he lived that way. He was looking forward to Jesus, to heaven, to the renewed heavens and the renewed earth. Now, they didn't know every detail. They might not have known Jesus's first name and surname, date of birth, or postcode, but they were looking forward to the serpent crusher. They were looking forward to the renewal of all things. They were looking forward to the inheritance that we are still looking forward to. And that is why their life of faith in future promises is here to encourage us to live our life of the same faith in the same future promises. See, that's why Hebrews has been using the land of Canaan as this example, this analog of our future inheritance. Because we're a bit like they are with regard to Canaan. They lived in Canaan already. They lived in the place that they knew eventually in the future their descendants would inherit. But they also knew it wouldn't be theirs in their lifetime. They were in their permanent final dwelling, but they weren't there permanently, just like us. Where will God spend all eternity future after Jesus returns? Right here on earth. Heaven comes down to earth. Heaven and earth get renewed when Jesus comes. Where are we going to spend all eternity? Right here. This right here is our permanent home, but not as it is now. And it's not permanent to us just yet. The same with them, with the land of promise. So is this world our home? Is it not our home? Well, imagine a Dutchman living in Holland in 1942? Is he living at home, or is he not living in his own fatherland? Well, in one sense, yes, Holland is his father's country. It rightfully belongs to him and to his people. But in 1942, it had been invaded by an enemy, by a hostile usurper. The fatherland had an interloper running it. So you would have to live, wouldn't you, in a place that was at one and the same time mine but not mine. So it is with this world. This world has been invaded and occupied by sin. We remain in a spiritual war that is still in effect. We are under the occupation of sin. And so, like anybody else living under enemy occupation, well, you'd invest carefully, wouldn't you, in your fatherland? You'd be careful to invest in things that will last and that make sense, trusting that the occupation won't last forever. You're not going to invest trusting the occupation is permanent. That's how Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac, and Jacob lived. They invested in a burial ground because they knew that the land would belong to their descendants long after they were dead. They didn't bother buying up lots of other plots of land because they knew they wouldn't be theirs for long. I used Holland as an illustration because a friend of mine tells me that his denomination came into being in 1944 when a synod met and forced a split over something apparently trivial and ridiculous. And my friend keeps saying to me, can you believe that with a war on, with the Nazis on our streets, we had nothing better to do than to rend our denomination in half? And of course you can see what he's getting at. But I hope you can also see that there's something sensible and commendable about what that synod did in 1944. Not that the decision made sense, but the fact that they were saying to the watching world, this Nazi occupation will come and go, but the kingdom of God will remain forever. And so much as it makes sense to fight to liberate the fatherland from the Nazis, it makes even more sense not to neglect right now the management and stewardship of the kingdom of God and to keep fighting the real occupying power of sin and Satan. You keep your eye on the heavenly things, and it makes you do things which seem bizarre and irrelevant and senseless, unless, of course, the heavenly things and the heavenly future are true and guaranteed. See, we know that God is busy building a better city. And that even though we now live in our fatherland is under the enemy occupation, not of the EU, but of sin. And so we live in the light of the certain return of Jesus to liberate the fatherland, to liberate earth, to free the whole world from sin and Satan. Think back to 1865. I'm not accusing any of you of remembering it firsthand, but the Southern Presbyterian Church finds that it cannot even meet for its General Assembly in April of 1865. The Civil War is coming to an end, and the country is in utter chaos. Finally, in December, the war is at an end, and they have a General Assembly. And the state of the nation, you can't even believe the extent of chaos and carnage and destruction. And churches that 4 years earlier had 30 adult members now have 3, and possibly fewer than, the right number of limbs between them. And what do? Well, they change their name, they elect a moderator, and they immediately, as their first order of business after that, is set up a board for overseas missions. And within a year, 2-3 years, they've got missionaries in Japan, in Colombia, in Guatemala, in Mexico, in parts of Africa. But the fatherland has been destroyed. Their entire Confederate project has come crumbling down. There is famine, there's privation, there is all manner of need. Yeah, but God's mission is a guaranteed success. God's mission is a guaranteed future investment. We're not going to let, as we meet here, the current state of our circumstances make us forget what God is about, what God guarantees. And I'm sure there are plenty of Mexicans, Colombians, Japanese guys, Africans who are jolly grateful that in 1865 a load of Presbyterians didn't sit around and say, woe is me, our nation is dead, our seminary is endowed with Confederate money that is now worthless, our magazine can't buy paper. No, they just, right, Bob, you ready to go to Japan? When you've learnt the language, go. Because by faith, faith lives now in light of the future. Faith lives in this world in light of Jesus. And thirdly and lastly, faith is radically rational. Faith is radically rational. See with me, verse 17, if you would. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. You see the problem? God had promised that through Isaac he would have children, and now is telling him to kill Isaac. So what does faith do? It reasons radically. It reasoned like this. It said, two things are certain. One, God will bless the whole world through Isaac. That is certain. Two, God requires me to sacrifice Isaac. Therefore, by good and necessary consequence, by basic logic, somehow after I have killed Isaac, Isaac must still be alive. And so, reasons a bit more, it must be because God is going to raise him from the dead. Now, it didn't quite work out that way, but the reasoning is impeccable. The fact that I'm free to obey the command because God will keep his promise, no matter what it looks like, that worked out well. You reason by faith from what is unquestioningly true, from what is absolutely certain, which is that God always keeps his command, his promises, so that we're free to obey his commands. Verse 19 says that Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead. That is faith. Faith is radically rational. But you see, to be rational, what you need is all the information. Not just what your eyes can see, not just what people around you might consider to be a good bet or reasonable. We need what God says explicitly in his word. Radical reasoning refuses to reason from faulty premises. It rests on what God clearly and explicitly says. And so that is why, by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. And verse 21, by faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. By faith Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. Now, what do all of these have in common? Imminent death. These are all people about to depart this earth. And radical reasoning made each of them continue to invest in their future, even though their doctors had said, you have no future. They didn't go into a palliative care ward with new age nurses trained to tell them to remember your favorite holiday or whatever it is and distract yourself and fade away painlessly. No, they kept busy. They knew about the promises to their children, and they continued to invest their resources, which at this point is their prayers, in them. They continued to live until the end, just as they had lived, which is how it is by faith. Faith that lives now in light of the future. Faith that lives in this world in the light of Jesus. Faith that is radically rational. Can I invite us all to be radically rational? See, why do faith and works keep appearing together in the Bible? Because they both involve the same thing. simple trust that God tells the truth, that his promises are good. So if you trust that God will save you because he has promised it, well, trust God that the Christian life, that the life lived under his word, that investing yourself into the kingdom of heaven is the best way to live. Because he too has promised it. Let me tell you about two people. One in a church that's been left open for the afternoon on Bishopsgate on Black Monday. Don't know his name, but he's there like this. He's just seen on his computer screen the school fees, the holiday home, the mortgage, the car, the career, everything has just turned from digital plenty to digital nothing. Let me tell you about another man. Harder up than this man, in fact. A man who, when he wants to buy a house, needs a mortgage. A man who, when he flies across the Atlantic, flies cattle class. David Green, CEO and owner of Hobby Lobby, the US equivalent of B&Q, I guess. According to Forbes magazine, I just looked him up, he's worth $6.4 billion. And he can't buy his daughter a house outright. He doesn't get the extra legroom when he flies over to Tyndale House to bless them. He's, to my certain knowledge, spent $1.2 billion of that fortune scattering Christian literature around the countries of the earth. One of those two men is a fool. The other one is living wisely. And please, I've used this illustration because I think it's just so clear, but don't misunderstand me. I'm not here shilling for your money. Okay, this is not the church elder saying we've got a budget coming up. That's why I'm doing this now, not when there's a budget coming up. But it just illustrates that the life that lives in the light of what God has promised will always look ridiculous to the world, but is commended in the light of God's certain promises on Judgment Day. We live by faith in the light of what is certain, and we don't invest far too much in what is merely probable or even uncertain.